Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Okay, folks, welcome to the Gone to the Dogs podcast. This is your co-host, Corey Groover, speaking. I know this is a voice that you guys aren't familiar with yet, but let me assure you, hopefully you'll be well acquainted with me moving forward into the future. But more importantly, I'm here to introduce our more common host to the podcast and the one that you're all here to hear. If he was a coon dog, he would have an all grand pedigree, Mr. Stephen Fielder. Insert applause now.
I like it when you talk about common, because you nailed it when you said I'm the more common voice. And you talk about the grands. Yeah, I'm a grandpa. I got grandchildren. So
great grandson.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Corey, I tell you what, buddy, we're going to have to polish that intro a little bit. You need a little more excitement.
Okay. And, all right. Hey, I thought that wasn't too bad for my
No. It's tolerable. You should have heard the first one I introduced years ago. But, you know, with me speaking in a microphone was something that I did for years. In fact, even when I was a young person in my church at home, I used to be a worship leader. And, you know, I would lead the congregation in singing. Back in those days, it was hymns from a hymnal, from a
book. The good stuff. The good stuff.
Yeah, you know. And so a mic in my face is not something that I'm intimidated by, and I know a lot of people wish that I were more so.
Well, I can relate to that, Steve. I was a bass player in our little youth group worship band that we had back in the day. So I had such long hair back then that I couldn't see a microphone if it was in front of my face anyways. So,
well, I bet you and Alan Gingrich had some good times back at UKC. Alan's an old hippie, too, you know. I mean, he and Paul, I think it was Paul, was the brother that he was in a band with and all that. So, yeah, I tell you what, I'm in the presence of greatness here.
My hair was so long back in the day.
How long was it?
Well, I'm going to tell you, it was so long that anytime I put my bump cap on to go coon hunting, my hair would come straight down along the side of my head and would curl over the ridges of the bump cap.
Yeah, that reminds me of a little story. Surprise, surprise. Before I went in the Air Force in 1969, I had just gotten out of college, and the Air Force put me on a delayed enlistment deal. They had kind of a backup in their schedule, I guess, or whatever. But so it gave me a little bit of time to do some things. And my dad and I decided to take a trip down to Tennessee to the farm where he was raised and spend a week or 10 days with my uncle, my dad's younger brother. So one of the first things I needed to do when we got down there, this was in May, of course, there's a stream that flows through the farm there that we commonly call the creek. And the one thing that you do when you go to the Fielder farm is you go to the creek, because it's got some tremendous smallmouth bass fishing in it. And or is known for its smallmouth bass fishing, so we love to do that. And also, we went downtown to the local hardware store there in Dixon, Tennessee, and that's just about 30 miles west of Nashville on Interstate 40, for those of you who want a geography lesson along with your podcasting experience. But at any rate, we were in there, and the guy behind the counter, he was asking the questions, you know, my name, my age. And my uncle was standing there alongside, or right nearby. And so when he got to the eyes, they're blue. He said hair. My uncle said long. And he was an old merchant seaman. You know, my dad's brothers, I won't get into all that history, but the younger brother was in the Navy. The older brother was in the Marine Corps. My dad was in the Army. So they were all military guys. And so they were always nice, short haircuts and all this. And here I show up, you know, I'm just a few days away from getting my locks shorn by the barber. That it basically asks everybody how you want it, you know, and then proceeds to give you a buzz cut that digs furrows down in your scalp with that hot clipper where he's been doing like 100 other guys before you. But anyway, that's my hair story, guys. So Corey was in a hair band, huh?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, you know, music has always been a big part of my life. I've enjoyed it so much. My dad was a fiddle player and grew up there in that Tennessee old-time fiddling barn dance culture, you know, as a kid. And then when I got in high school, met a guy that moved into our town my senior year, Ron Vanover, and Ron was a picker, and so he showed me how to play rhythm guitar, chords on a guitar. That's about as far as I ever got with it. But I enjoyed playing, and I did so all through high school and college. So, you know, and I saw some writings by Dave Dean at one time, and he had mentioned at the Bellevue, Michigan Club how he'd gotten together with Todd Kellum, UKC, and myself and somebody else, and Dave played a little. Did you ever play with Dave? Corey?
No.
Okay. But anyway, he was mentioning that. And I know one time or two, I took the guitar down to the tennis center in Aurora. And, you know, when the cats were out, we had a little fun with that. There were other pickers, you know, along among the field reps that played a little bit. So, yeah, had a lot of fun with it.
I can remember during my interview that I had with UKC, I was in an interview with Todd Kellum and Alan Gingrich, and in walked Wayne Kavanaugh, who was the residing president of the United Kennel Club at the time. And that was kind of an intimidating experience at first, you know. And he came in and he said, "I only got a couple questions for you." And one of those questions was, "Do you play an instrument?" And I said, "Well," I was like, I do play an instrument. I pick a little bit of bass in my free time. And, you know, I've played in different bands and stuff like that. And he said, "Good, you're going to fit right in. We need a bass player."
Take it on the road, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So you guys were like Willie Nelson on the road again, running up and down the road in that motorhome, right?
That was a pretty good impression of Willie. That was good. I like that. I appreciate that.
I do not have a giant doobie here, guys, while we're recording this podcast. I do not partake of the left-handed cigarettes, just in case anyone's asking. But, no, a lot of good times on the road on those trips, you know. Over the years at UKC, when I was there, we had Fred Miller liked his Winnebagos.
Oh, yeah.
And we had three different motorhomes in the time that I was there. And, we didn't actually stay in them. We never spent the night in those motorhomes. We just used them for an office on wheels and a good place to take a nap while somebody else was driving. And of course, there was always the endless snacks on board. And boy, the stories I should tell. I should write a book about being on the road.
Yeah.
You know, so many thousands of miles. That Ford F-150 that's sitting out in my driveway right now has 280,000 miles on it.
Wow.
And almost all those miles had something to were hauling a dog, going hunting or fishing somewhere. But
well, Steve, I know that we're real glad that we can't see your odometer and see how many miles are on that
my personal odometer. Yeah. Yeah, and I tell you what, I'm feeling every single one of them these days. I heard about the aches and pains all my life. Well, they're real, folks.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, man. Hey, what we got to talk about tonight, Corey? We're going to just sit here and just dazzle this audience with our brilliant. Are we, as Bill O'Reilly used to say, we're just going to bloviate for an hour and a half?
I think we have a popular topic that's been requested numerous times that we're going to cover tonight. We're going to hit on a few current events as well. Something that's relative to my neck of the woods specifically, and that is a piece of legislation. That's an eerie word, legislation, for all of us coon hunters out there. A piece of legislation that was introduced in the state of Pennsylvania, specifically Senate Bill 1087. Senate Bill 1087 was a piece of legislation that was introduced that was going to limit the acts and privileges of hunting dog enthusiasts in the state of Pennsylvania. That's something that we've been keeping a pulse on here in the state for a while. And we've gotten good news here in the past couple of days that we're making headway with that. So I just wanted to kind of make an announcement about that and kind of talk about that a little bit with you and see what you think.
Well, I got a phone call just before we sat down to record today from my good buddy, one of your friends and neighbors up there in Pennsylvania, Randy Smith. And I said, "What you been doing, bud?" And he said, "I've been on the phone all day." And I said, "What's going on? You selling puppies or what?" He said, "No, I'm concerned, you know, about this bill that could basically put us out of business up here as hunters." And of course, Randy, as we know, is a coon hunter and also a beagler. And so he kind of let me in on what, you know, the bill and so forth. And we kind of talked about that. The way these things work, as I understand, this bill was introduced. You probably got the names there in front of you, Corey. I do not. Who was the senator that introduced this bill? Do you have it?
One of the main senators that introduced it was Senator Rothman.
Yeah, and is he over east there?
More towards the eastern part of the state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sportsman's Alliance has gotten a hold of this, and there's a bulletin out by them talking about the bill. And as we're speaking here tonight, tomorrow will be March the 19th. And I just remembered that was my mother's birthday, and mom's been gone a couple years now. But anyway, there's a hearing tomorrow. It's a committee hearing on this bill. And the concern, the bill was, it's one of these trespass bills that well-meaning but undereducated lawmakers tend to pick up and try to run with because they think it's going to give their constituents the warm and fuzzies because it's going to address the sanctity of landowners and their ability to decide who and when others can enter upon their lands. And as it should be, there definitely has to be some sort of control of one's domain, so to speak, or domicile. And so anyway, we fought these things for years in my years at UKC and PKC recreational trespass laws and so forth. And this one was particularly concerning because it basically addressed a dog as a trespasser and the owner of the dog as a trespasser, you know. And as you explained to me earlier, Corey, and you might want to elaborate on this, in the state of Pennsylvania, while you don't have a right to retrieve law as such, you do have the privilege of going without a firearm, I guess, onto the land where your dog has entered and retrieving that dog and getting back off. Is that pretty much the way it works?
Yeah. So the way that it works here in the state of Pennsylvania is under existing law, there's an exemption that is extended specifically to the owner of a hunting dog that allows the owner of that hunting dog or the handler of that hunting dog to enter onto posted property to retrieve said dog without explicit permission from the landowner themselves. And the whole idea behind that exemption is we want to prevent a problem from occurring before it happens, so to speak. So that is an exemption that came in through much of the purple paint law that entered the state with probably within the last decade. And that exemption has stood for a long while now. But the bill that's being introduced, Senate Bill 1087, would eliminate the hunter's ability to retrieve the dog and not only make it a felony, it would also criminalize the dog to a certain extent. If the dog was on the property without the landowner's explicit permission, then there's just as much of a felony charge there as what it would be if you were just retrieving the dog. So luckily for us, a lot of us in the state, the different sporting dog organizations and individuals have contacted their state representatives to try and communicate our concerns about the elimination of the exemption. And just at 5 o'clock today, I received notification from Senator Rothman's office. And Senator Rothman was the sponsoring Senate delegate for this bill, that they were going to not reinstate, but they were going to ensure that the exemption is left intact for these different rules that exist.
Okay. Well, again, folks, you know, we're coming to you on a Monday, actually a week later than this was recorded. So on Tuesday, which will be Tuesday past for those that are listening on Monday morning, will be the hearing, or the hearing has been held. And of course, at this point, we don't know what the outcome of that is. We hope that it's positive all the way and this thing can just be killed in committee. And that would be the end of it. I hesitate to say that because behind these kinds of bills, there's always the urging of groups like Humane Society of the United States, the ASPCA, and various animal rights. There's no such thing. That's an oxymoron. An animal cannot have rights without responsibilities. So, but at any rate, we're going to, here's what I would caution listeners about this bill. Watch it. What's the bill number again, Corey?
1087, Senate Bill 1087.
Okay. Go online, look the bill up, see who the sponsors are. You should, if you're under the sound of my voice in the state of Pennsylvania, you should know who your senators are. And you definitely, like my buddy Randy Smith, need to be calling that senator. And any of the members, you can look, and do you know what committee this is in, Lord, Corey, does it say?
Senate Game and Fisheries Committee.
Okay. So you can go online in the state of Pennsylvania and look up that the committee members on that committee, and it'll give you all their contact information, their emails or whatever. You need to contact each member of that committee. Now, I would caution you to go ahead and do that, assuming that this thing has, I won't say it's been, will have been voted out of committee by the time you're listening to me, but it may still be active. So if you care about your ability to hunt with a coonhound or a beagle or a bird dog or a retriever or a feist squirrel dog or any kind of hunting animal, hunting dog in the state, if you're a bird hunter that likes to hunt woodcock and grouse, as I said, waterfowl hunters, all of us are painted with the same brush here. So learn about this bill, look it up, read it, contact your senator and let them know that you disapprove of this, that it's unnecessary, that you have laws in place already to deal with this. And, the thing that bothers me, I heard Randy told me today that he was assured by Rothman's, am I getting that right, Rothman?
Yes.
Okay. Rothman's office, that the dog language is being taken out of this bill. Well, my immediate question was, what about the human that's hunting the dog? Is he still affected by this trespass? How can he go and retrieve his dog? Maybe the dog's not going to be charged. What are they going to do to the dog? Incarcerate the dog? I doubt it. But the human that's attached to the other end of the leash is the one that we're concerned about.
And I might extend that thought in the regard of, it's important to contact your state representatives to make them aware of your presence within the state and to make them aware of the traditions that exist within your state. I might even extend that to include contacting the Pennsylvania Game Commission themselves. Obviously, this is a Pennsylvania Game Commission related committee that's being held or hearing that's being held, and obviously they're going to be involved with that conversation. And one thing that I can say about the bill is I'm pretty confident that this is just simply an oversight. That's at least what I'm hoping that this whole brigade is, as far as removing the hunting dog exemption specifically. Pennsylvania has always been a place of opportunity for sportsmen, and it's always been a place of well-rounded sportsmen on top of that. So even the people who enjoy deer hunting or turkey hunting to a large extent, like we do hound hunting, they may have experience with hound hunting directly, or they may dabble in it with friends or anything like that. So it's not that, I don't think this is a specific target towards houndsmen and their ability to do what they love to do. I certainly hope that's the case. So I'm hopeful that everything will go smoothly in this hearing.
Well, we always are hopeful, but let me play the old cynic here for a minute. The state of Pennsylvania doesn't have a bear season with hounds.
Correct.
And that's been successfully defeated, over the years, or held at bay, so to speak. I like that. That's pretty cool.
I like that.
So there is an element there that doesn't get the warm fuzzies when they think about hound hunting. So we need to be aware of that at least. And something that I used to say, as I address groups all over the country, I would say that any time there is a town council meeting, a county commission meeting, a legislative committee meeting, such as what we're talking about, that will be conducted on March 19th there in Pennsylvania, there is the opportunity for somebody to introduce a bill, an ordinance, a regulation that can put us out of business. And so vigilance is, I can't overstate the importance of being vigilant. Our friend Clay Newcomb with the Meat Eater organization used the term guard the gate.
Yep.
And we have to guard the gate. And we have to be vigilant, constantly watching. And believe me, when you defeat these people, they'll spring right back with something else. So it's an ongoing thing. But the question we all have to ask ourselves is, are these hounds worth it? It's a sport that we love worth it. Is it worth fighting for? Or are we going to be just fine when the law gets passed that says, we can't do what we love to do? And well, I think we all know that answer.
And to a greater extent, this is basically the state calling our bluff, you know, and the fact that we have to assume ownership of our sport and our traditions. And if we aren't willing to do that, then yes, they will go by the wayside. And yes, other people will make decisions for us, whether we like it or not. So as much as we like the trophies, as much as we like going to the club and participating in events, as much as we like raising a beautiful litter of puppies, we have a responsibility to step up to the plate when these sorts of situations arise. And it's not enough to just sit back and give support to those who are speaking about it on your behalf. It takes a multitude of voices to be heard.
Absolutely. And it's so easy for us now. You know, just go Google, use that magic Google machine and Google that bill and look up the contact information and pick up the phone or shoot an email. Okay. And, you know, my friend Randy asked me if I would write a letter in, you know, stating our position there. And I told him I would do that. And, you know, we all can do something, okay? We all can do something. And it's easy for us now. It's right there on the screen in front of us. So anyway, we're going to stop beating that horse tonight, but we hope, or today, but we hope that you will take action on behalf of my sport, Corey's sport, and ultimately your own sport, and voice your opinion that you are opposed to Senate Bill
1087.
Thank you, Corey. Okay, Corey, you and I were kind of bumping around talking about this and that around this hot stove today, and about what we wanted to talk about with our audience. And we've been kind of kicking this one around for a while that we might get into some breed discussions, the various breeds of dogs. And, you know, we all kind of pick one usually that we like, and we kind of stick with it over the years. Everybody knows that mine is the plot breed, and I gotta put in a shameless plug. Thank you to the American Plot Association this past weekend at their breed days for voting our boy Fever, Bear Pin Fever, as Coon Dog of the Year. Man, that made me proud. And yeah, I was especially,
congratulations to you.
Thank you, bud. And I was especially proud and glad and appreciative of my buddy Mark Miller, who has done 100% of the work with that little dog, and he likes him. They're a great team together, and they had a lot of fun. They played all the games. They did tree and contests and water races and field trials and a night hunt, and I think he totally wore himself. Mark did Friday. Yeah. It rained all day, and he said, "Man, I'm not going to the woods tonight. I'm wore out fighting this." And fever's Woo. Not easy, because when you get him around games to play, man, he goes into he is wound like a $2 watch, boy. You know. So it's I'm sure Mark been keeping him lassoed all week, all day was more than he wanted to deal with. But anyway, had a great time there. Mark did, and he everybody that was there reported that they really had a good time. And I think I saw online somewhere that the gate, they do charge a gate going in, and I think it was over 1,700 people that went through the gate and paid the fee there.
Wow.
So that's a pretty nice event there.
That sure is.
Greenville, Tennessee. Hats off to the American Plot Association and everybody that works. There's one guy there in that association that is just a workhorse. And I mean, he's always involved in doing things. And a greater guy you will never meet in this sport, Gary Bowen. From Virgilina, North Carolina. I hunted with Gary several times when I lived in Raleigh. He is just a tremendous guy and a very hard worker. I know Gary wouldn't want the credit for anything, but from me to you, Bo, you're doing a great job down there, and I appreciate it so much. All right. We decided that we were going to talk about a breed of dogs that really was probably the oldest coonhound breed registered by UKC, I believe it was, but it was certainly one of the three original breeds way back in 1898 when they started registering dogs there in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Funny story, Corey, I don't know if you heard it, but Chauncey Bennett, the founder of UKC, he put the address as Chicago, Illinois, and then the mail came over on the train from Chicago to Kalamazoo, because he didn't feel like anybody would want to do business with a registry founded or headquartered in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He no thought kidding. Chicago sounded a lot more uptown, and he may have been competing with AKC, of course, being in New York City. So, but anyway, sure. We're going to talk a little bit about black and tans, aren't we?
Yeah, the breed of first impressions, because they were, in fact, first in many of the different registries that are currently registering purebred dogs.
Yeah, when I went to AKC, when you talked about coonhounds, there was only one breed. And that was the American Black and Tan Coonhound.
Yes, sir.
That was a coonhound. End of story. You know.
And I can remember the days I spent showing in AKC confirmation shows when I was a kid. And that was the only coonhound breed that was recognized at the time. That would have been early 2000s. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was my job when I went to AKC in 2004. Was to bring those other breeds, those UKC breeds, into full recognition with AKC. And thankfully, and with the good Lord's help and a lot of other folks too, we were able to accomplish that before I retired in 2010. So, or 2011, actually. Well, the black and tan coonhound, of course, you know, they called him the Old Glory Hound. He was the companion dog of the settlers, you know, that headed west in the wagon trains and all of that, and went across what was called the Darby Plains of Ohio. And the black and tan, you know, was a trail hound, of course, and I'm sure he originated from the English and Irish and French hounds. I'm sure the mixture of those breeds, you know, that came over with the colonists to this country. And so anyway, he's been around for a long, long time. I wrote an essay in my book and talked about the first time I went to a field trial and hearing these black and tans coming up over the hill with their long balls and well behind all the greyhound mixes and all that came through on the field trial drag, you know, way ahead of them. But faithfully, they came right on through and treed on the tree. So it's fun to think back about those old dogs because they were, in many cases, the origin of coon hunting in the U.S. prior to the walker, you know, bursting on the scene.
Yeah, they really paved the way for the rest of the breeds to come on through, you know, in a professional sense, but also in a holistic sense. You know, they being the first breed of coonhound that was recognized by many of these different registries, you know, a lot of people in the purebred dog sports didn't have experience with coonhounds or at least owning them. And the black and tan breed is certainly a professional breed, in the fact that the people that promote these dogs are always professional. They're always industry leaders. They're very much commonplace in many of the national level competitions that you're going to see, whether that's in the show ring or in the woods. So they are a breed of extreme integrity, and they're very much well represented and well worth talking about. For that reason.
Oh, for sure they are. And, you know, I've got a lot of reference material and rattled in various places. I go to my friend David McKee down in South Carolina, go to his home, and he's got a whole room in his house that's a library with shelves like a library full of hunting volumes and all, and I wish I had all my magazines and publications organized that way, but I've been through a few moves, and when we downsized and came to Florida and I now live in a retirement community, I don't have the luxury of having a lot of extra room for that sort of thing, but I have managed to hold on to those things. And you know, I don't know where I would be without friends, and I'm sure most of you out there feel the same way. But I've got a book here, and I'm showing it to you here, Corey. It's all about black and tans, and it was written by Bill Boatman and E.J. Ralston. Now, Boatman, many people know about because of his dog supply and hunting supply business in Bainbridge, Ohio. He was the number one for many, many years before people like John Wick, for instance, burst on the scene. But there were a lot of dog supply houses around the country, and when Full Cry and American Cooner were published, they all advertised in those magazines. But this book, I want to talk just a little bit about this book. There is a signature here on the first page. It says, "To my good friend, Homan Fielder." Now, listeners will know that was my dad. "May your journey to the happy hunting ground be filled with God's richest blessings." And then he says, E.J. Ralston, May 8th, 1978. And then he gives a Bible verse reference, which I did not look up, but it's Proverbs 12, 27, and 28.
You want me to read that for
us? Yeah.
Okay. "The lazy man does not roast game, But diligence is man's precious possession. In the way of righteousness is life, and in its pathway there is no death. That's beautiful.
That's neat. That's neat. Junior Ralston was a unique individual. And I guess to rewind the tape just a little bit, Bill Boatman was a black and tan fancier. He loved his black dogs. And he kind of went on a quest to go out and buy as many good stud dogs and good black and tans as he could. But he knew that he did not have the personal, perhaps the time or the network in the black and tan breed that Everett Ralston had. Now, let me read real quick this little bio, and you'll get the idea of who E.J. Ralston was. Everett Ralston is known by the nickname Junior to coon hunters in many states. He began coon hunting in 1941 in southwestern Indiana. He was from over around Terre Haute, Indiana, is where he was from. His school bus driver was a coon hunter and would tell Junior what time he'd pick him up that night for a coon hunt. After a 20-year career as a sales representative of the Hallman Company of Terre Haute, Indiana, Junior entered the Appalachian Bible Institute at Bradley, West Virginia, where he earned a bachelor's degree in May of 1978. Okay, Bill Boatman wanted Junior Ralston because of his network of black and tan hunters. And Junior had been very active. In fact, well, this is kind of funny. My father and I were sitting on the porch in Beckley, West Virginia. West Virginians are notorious porch sitters, especially after dinner. Supper, excuse me.
Yeah, there you go.
And we were sitting there as I was on a I'm not sure. I may have been living in Beckley at that time, shortly after I came home from the military. And then I moved up to eastern Ohio for a period of time with my job. But anyway, we were sitting there, and a car pulled up in front of the house. And this fella got out. And he walked up the walk, and he says, "Is this the Fielder residence?" And one of the other of us acknowledged that it was. And he introduced himself as Junior Ralston. Well, immediately that name jumped off the pages of Full Cry and American Cooner magazine, because I'd been reading stories about Junior and his exploits with his black and tan dogs, you know, for many years. And so I immediately recognized him, and he was quite surprised that we knew who he was. But anyway, that opened a friendship. At that time, he was still in college there in our town, and I hadn't known that at all up until that point. So anyway, as the years went on, then Junior and I got to, you know, to be very close and corresponded a lot and saw each other at the events, and was really saddened when I heard that Junior had passed away. But anyway, he and Bill Boatman got together and wrote this book all about black and tans. And it's a good one. And then on the cover it says, "Old Bruiser." It shows a black and tan male here on the tree. And it says, "Old Bruiser Treeing." Cover story is on page 4. And boys and girls, if you'll turn to page 4 in your All About Black and Tans, the dog that he was calling Bruiser was indeed Night Champion Eads Black Bruiser. Was born November 11th, 1964. That was the year that I graduated high school, and lived 13 years, 2 months, and 16 days. Now, remember that, kiddies. There's going to be a pop quiz. Lee Eads, a well-known coon hunter, owned his sire and started Bruiser on his rise to fame.
Now, that's here's quite another, the name for a black and tan, Bruiser.
Bruiser.
That's a good name for one.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
The old guys, they knew how to name these dogs, man. They put some character in them, you know?
Yes, they did.
And here's another famous black and tan man back in that era. So black and tans were quite popular in Ohio and in Kentucky. But he says here, Ivan Clark later owned Bruiser before selling him to Owen Bowman. Now, I met Ivan Clark and Owen Bowman through Junior Ralston at Black and Tan Days. When I went to UKC in 1983, Black and Tan Days was one of the largest coonhound events that we held. It was bigger than Walker Days. It was, if not bigger, almost as big as the Texas State Championship, which was a leader back in those days in the early 80s. So we're talking about here, right here, Lee Eads. Lee was a famous black and tan man. His brother, Duel Eads. And I believe, Corey, if I'm not mistaken, Daryl was either a son or grandson of one of these guys. And Daryl Eads made some noise. Tongue in cheek.
Specifically the phrase yatta hay. I remember that. He used there when back in 2000 at the 2015 UKC World Hunt. I was in attendance at that hunt, and actually we had two black and tans that made the final cast that year, made the final four, and Daryl Eads was one of those guys with a dog he called Big Slick. And Daryl used to yell "Yatta hay." I don't remember what it meant or where it came from or why he said it, but he used to yell that, and he was yelling that in the woods that night too.
I'm going to take a stab at that.
Okay.
The old saying, "What the heck?" You know, what the heck's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Later was kind of evolved into "What the hay." What the hey, Corey? You know, unfortunately, now it's gone to its lowest depths, you know, and
sure,
and all. But I imagine that's what Daryl was saying. What the heck, guys? Yeah. You know?
That's quite possible.
But anyway, here, getting back, so, you know, these were all guys, Ivan Clark, Owen Bowman, were guys that Junior Ralston introduced me to as being fellows that really knew the black and tan hound and you know, hunted a better class of black dog. And, of course, this is, you know, they were there in the times of guys like Joe Bloodworth, a dog named Black Bill. That's a great historic name. That black and tan fanciers will remember. But anyway, this little story of Bruiser, and we'll move along. Bruiser was bought by Bill Boatman as the prepotent hound neared 12 years of age. So Bill thought that Bruiser was prepotent. In other words, we use that term to describe a dog that you could breed to a collie and he'd produce a tree dog. You know, I mean, that was a common thing. He headed Wildwood Kennels, and that was the name of Bill Boatman's kennel, till he passed on to the Happy Hunting Grounds. His offspring continued to influence the great black and tan breed and undoubtedly will for many years. Coon hunters in many states hunt and proudly own his progeny. So there's a look back at a black and tan hound. And a couple of guys, you know, that were really dyed-in-the-wool black and tan fanciers. And they wrote this book, and the book is, you know, chapter one is early history. I would advise you guys, if you can find this on eBay or somewhere, see if you can get a copy, because it really is a good read, especially if you like the Black Dogs. And it talks about... Go ahead.
I'm definitely going to look for it.
Yeah, yeah. And the chapters go early history. And then this is an interesting thing because it does kind of bring us where we are today, or at least it's the beginning of the evolution, if you will, of the black and tan hound from the long-eared, slow-trailing, heavy-bodied, deep-chested, deep-voiced, original black and tan to what for many years was called the medium-eared black and tan. And this introduction here about the formative years will explain that, and I'll read it in just a minute. Coon hunters have always taken great pride in owning the best dog in their area. When black and tans were being developed, communications were limited. While hunters knew one another within a county or a few counties, only a few of them sought hounds from other areas. To those who did the searching, the rewards were great. One such black and tan man was J.F. Hans, H-A-N-S, or Hans, Wagner, first at Newton and later at Waterloo, Iowa. The Hans Wagner hounds were featured in an old magazine, Hunter, Trader, Trapper, back as far as 1912. Man, that's a long time ago.
It sure is.
Okay. Anyway, he talks about Hans Wagner's mother was from an old Southern family. The Cheeks were their names. And as a child, he heard his mother relate how her grandpappy went bear hunting in the mountains of Tennessee and was never heard of again. Whew, that's pretty rough. His father, grandfather, and even great-grandfather were woodsmen, houndsmen, and horsemen. One of Hans' earliest recollections is being lifted over the old rail fences by his father on some coon hunts. So they go ahead and talk about Hans Wagner. Now, Hans Wagner was a real colorful guy. He was a window dresser by trade, meaning that he was employed by department stores to create the window dressings for their stores. People, the term window shopping, would walk by and see what the latest and greatest furniture or clothing or whatever. But anyway, he ran these fantastic ads in Full Cry magazine and in the Bloodlines, which was a forerunner of Coonhound Bloodlines. And so there's basically a chapter here about Hans and the formative years, you know, with the black and tan. So that's if you hear about the Wagner bred black and tans, I'm going to have to kind of get back into my memory here. The fellas out in Iowa that kind of carried that on. One of them was a field rep for us at one time, and his son, Marshall White. Thank you, Lord. Marshall White kind of carried on the Wagner bred coonhounds and his son as well for quite some time. So anyway, great old book about black and tan coonhounds. And I mentioned Joe Bloodworth, and he was famous for the Bloodworth ear canker remedy that was advertised in Full Cry and American Cooner for many, many years. So, a lot of history with the black and tan breed. And Junior went ahead, you know, and found several good dogs and brought them to Bill Boatman's kennel. And then they were advertised and promoted, you know, across the country. But man, there's some beautiful, beautiful hounds in here. And just a real good read for history buffs. All About Black and Tans, Bill Bowman and E.J. Ralston. What say you, Corey?
That is some really great history.
Yeah.
It's nice when you can get the real specific stuff. You know, not all this general mamsy-pansy stuff that you might read on the internet.
How to raise and train a black and tan. Available at your local pet store. Chapter 1. This is a leash, a feed bowl,
so,
and a water bucket. Okay.
How much experience with the black and tan breed do you have personally?
Well, the first coon dog that I remember my dad having was a grade black and tan. And I think our listeners know what we mean when we say grade. That was a dog that was not registered and typically crossbred. My dad was a pipe fitter, and the first year that I was in school was in, I went to school in the state of Missouri. My dad was working at Kevel, Kentucky, across the river. It was right where the Ohio River enters the Mississippi, and across the river from what's now become a ghost town, Cairo, Illinois. But anyway, we lived in Charleston, Missouri, and there was a local coon hunter, a barber there, whose last name was Dudley, not to be confused with Dudley Do-Right. But anyway, when my dad moved back to West Virginia, he had gotten two puppies from this barber. And one of them was black and tan, but he had white stocking feet and some white in his chest. The other was coal black and looked more like a lab. And these dogs were crossed, black and tan, blue tick, and bird dog. And anyway, Dad named his Sam. And Sam was the first coon dog that I remember we having. And then if you look on the cover of my book, On to the Dogs, A Coon Hunter's Journey, there's a picture of me when I was about 11 or 12 years old holding a plot pup and a black and tan female named Kate. Now, Kate was also a grade dog and had some white in her chest. So my earliest beginnings, you know, were with black and tans. But back in that day, most of the black and tans that I knew of that were being used for coon hunting were crossbreds because the old line black and tans, those old-fashioned long-eared dogs, weren't fast enough for the emerging coon hunter of the 50s and 60s, or when the competition coon hunters and coon hunts were emerging at that time. And of course, that was, you know, the era of the walker dog coming to the, you know, into the sport. And a lot of the older guys like me, if you talk to them, they'll talk about the fact that there weren't many walker dogs around back in those days.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, especially when I talk to a lot of the older fellas, not to insult you, Steve, but a lot of the older fellas that used to coon hunt in my area back in the day, a lot of them talk about having black and tan coon hounds. And actually, my dad has a cousin who had a really close relationship with my grandfather. And he did a lot of coon hunting with him, and he got it himself into dogs. And he hunted black and tans for a good long while. And specifically, if I can remember, he had at least one female that went back to the old Screaming Eagle dog, which is still talked about stud from recent history in the black and tan breed. But Yeah, a lot of these old guys had black and tans in their backyards.
Well, when I began my competition career, if you want to call it that, hunting in the night hunts, quite often I would go to Southwest Virginia to towns like Christiansburg or Tazewell or Marion or Bland and those towns, those clubs. The prominent figure in coon hunting in that era was a guy named W.L. Davis, commonly called Willie Davis. And Willie was known for his black and tan dogs. And you mentioned Midnight Screaming Eagle. Screaming Eagle was one of Willie's stud dogs. And he had several. And Willie was one of the first guys to make the coon jacket, the monogram jacket. I called them billboards. Popular, because when Willie walked in the clubhouse, of course, Willie was a very charismatic guy. I mean, everybody knew Willie, and when he came in the room, he was loud, he was laughing, he was joking, he was, you know, Mr. Coon Hunter for that era and that area. Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's funny that you bring up Willie specifically. I just happen to have an issue of the black and tan issue of Coonhound Bloodlines from 2008, which would have been the April issue. And they have articles from the Coonhound Bloodlines archives in that particular issue. And the topic of conversation is Willie Davis. And
how about that?
And it actually has a lot of good pictures.
You're
here.
Checking up on me, aren't you? You're trying to verify.
Well, as former President Trump would put it, I'm fact checking. Yeah.
All right. Okay, yeah, Willie Davis was indeed a very colorful guy. And there was another guy in our area named Gene Joyce that hunted black and tans and hunted some good dogs. And I mentioned before, and in fact, I saw it here. I also have from the archive here in front of me a copy of the 1972 American Black and Tan Coonhound Association yearbook. And in there, I saw an article, and if I can find that real quick, about a guy named Elwood Ferguson. Now, Elwood was from Virginia, and he was well known. He had a dog named Thunder Bill. He had one named True Bill. And these were dogs that they had the Bloodworth breeding. And he was a well-known black and tan man in that era. Let me see if he says here about when he started. Okay. He said, I was listening to older hunters tell of how a coon could outsmart a dog and get away. If the dog could catch him, what a fight you would see. In the year 1939, a friend told us that he had seen some coon tracks down on the river. So that strong desire to coon hunt led me to catch that coon. Anyway, he goes ahead and tells the story of that, and it. These old stories, man, they light my fire. I don't know what today's coon hunter is going to talk about when they get older. Are they going to talk about how they chased John Strickland for 2 miles through a freshly sown wheat field with their boots feeling like they weighed 30 pounds each. I don't know what they're going to talk about. Well, but I love listening or reading these old stories about these hunts back in the day.
Well, before we get off the topic of W.L. Davis or Willie Davis.
Okay, yeah.
I have a fun fact for you, and you might know this, you might not. But I'm just being made aware of this. Did you know that W.L. served as the president of the United English Breeders and Fanciers Association at one point in time in his life?
I did know that for sure. And now I will ask you a trivia question.
Oh, boy.
What was the name of the famous English stud dog that W.L. Davis owned and hunted and advertised?
I can't read that, dun, fast, dun, Steve. Dun, 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 oh, man. Dun. Well, it's not jumping off the page at me, so I guess you're going to have to tell me.
Rawhide. You remember the TV show, Rawhide?
I do remember that.
Yeah, man. Roll 'em.
I got that piece of information from this issue of Coonhound Bloodlines. There's actually a really cool photo here. It's a photo of Bill Wickham.
Wickham, my Bill Wickham, good friend.
Who was the president of the National Plowhound Association at that time. Lee Crawford, who, as many of you probably know, was the president of the Treeing Walker Breeders and Fanciers Association.
And a gentleman extraordinaire.
Yes. And our friend, W.L. Davis, who was not only a black and tan aficionado, apparently he was a full-fledged fancier of the English Coonhound breed. So that's pretty cool that three men representing four different breeds in that photo. That's really
That's true. And it took a guy like Willie to pull that off.
Oh, sure.
Because he had a bigger than life personality. and he would just, you know, that kind of stuff would just roll off his back. I'm going to tell a story that's probably not going to paint coon hunting in the greatest of light.
Okay. I'll allow it.
And thank goodness the sport has evolved since those days, or at least I think it has, and I hope it has. I was at a hunt in Marion, Virginia. The late Dean Testerman, listeners will remember Dean very well. He was a good friend of Willie's, and Dean was every bit as colorful and loud. He had a real gruff voice. He was a Walker man through and through and was very active with the Southeastern Treeing Walker Association, was a bench show judge and all. But anyway, it was down at Dean's club in Marion, Virginia. I'd gone out on a night hunt that night. Don't remember whether it did any good or not. My dad was with me. Those were may have been the days, and I'm sure they were, before I was old enough to drive. My dad would drive me to the hunts. At the club that night, sitting along the tables were formed in long lines, as they sometimes are in coon clubs, where it's these 8-foot tables end to end to end. So, you know, you sit there and you're likely sitting across from somebody else or whatever. You sit there and have your breakfast or your coffee or whatever. A gentleman, and I use that term loosely, had been visiting the local provider of the recipe for that area. Let's say he was not slightly, but well-oiled when he came through the door. He was inebriated. He was drunk.
Uh-oh.
Okay. And he walked in the clubhouse door, and he was unhappy with the results of one of the casts. And there was a gentleman sitting there, right, I was just sitting right nearby, And a fellow, I always remember this guy, and I won't use his name. I believe that he's passed on. Anyway, he was, as coon hunters were apt to do in that day, he was wearing Carhartt bibbed overalls. And he had both hands inside the bib of his coveralls. And he was sitting there at the table. And this gentleman, I always remember the guy, had on a sport coat, which is kind of unusual at a coon club, right?
Sure, yeah.
And this guy wasn't all that big, but I'll try to make this short, but it was so funny and yet not. The guy came across the table from where this fellow was sitting and apparently made a negative reference. Well, no apparent about it. I heard it. About this guy hunter's mother.
Ooh.
So you kind of know the term he used when he addressed this hunter. The hunter did not say a word. He simply eased the chair that he was leaning back on back to the ground, rose in a single motion as he retrieved his right hand from the bib of his overalls and launched himself forward and caught said gentleman right on the point of the chin with a fist that looked like a sledgehammer.
Woo.
Said gentleman went airborne backwards and hit the concrete floor, and his head smacked the floor two or three times before it stopped bouncing.
Ooh.
Very alarming, very scary for me.
Sure.
Okay. It made an impression on me. But being the good fireman that he was, immediately Willie Davis sprang into action, did CPR on this guy, mouth to mouth, the whole nine yards, and the guy got up off the floor and walked away.
Wow.
That's one of the things I remember about Willie. That is a scene that I hope never, ever gets replayed at a coon hunting club again. And I told my dad that night on the way home, I said, Dad, I didn't like that. And I don't ever want to be around that again. And if that's the way this, you know, it's going to be, I'm not going to go anymore. And of course, my dad and his wisdom. My dad was totally fearless. I mean, he was.
Sure. And,
you know, he didn't make any remark much about it at all, but he assured me that that was not normal behavior and that wasn't going to happen, you know, at best. But I'll never forget that night. not recommended, boys and girls, you know, but that's a memory of W.L. Davis that I'll always have. And I'll tell you one other little W.L. Davis thing. When Fred Miller was inquiring about hiring me, you mentioned when you went to UKC and Wayne Cavanaugh was there. And, you know, when Fred, and he told me this himself, Fred did. He said when he inquired about me from Willie Davis, who he knew Willie very well, and he said, you know, what about this guy? And Willie told him, he said, well, he's a hillbilly. This is the funny part. But he's a sophisticated hillbilly. What? Fred got a big laugh out of that. And he told me later that Willie said that about. But my good friend Lindell Price and Willie hunted together many years. And he would have so many Willie Davis stories. And Bob Justice, who was a guest on my podcast before, the coon hunting barber from Christiansburg, Virginia, had a lot of Willie Davis stories,
yeah.
You know. What a colorful character.
Christiansburg, Virginia, I think was the place that photo was taken that we were referring to.
I don't doubt that it was.
Lee Crawford. Yeah. And yeah. Well, so we've covered the gauntlet, I think, as far as a history lesson goes. Let's talk about some of the stuff that's going on in the current era with black and tan coonhounds specifically. What's going on with them?
Well, for one thing, they're resilient. I don't think the love for the black and tan coonhound has waned at all. And when I went to White River in 2010 for my first trip there, I was the only guy in camp that was hunting a dog other than a black and tan. Nubbin Moore, my longtime friend, he hunted black dogs for years. Mr. Fred Sanford was a black dog man. Kenneth Rains, who was there in camp, hunted black dogs. Frog Hayes was hunting black and tans. And their buddy, Mike Crockett, out there in Senatobia, Mississippi, has bred. He's famous for the Newt dog and a lot of dogs that came down out of that line. So the black and tan, and Chad McCoyne up in, I believe, in Illinois or Indiana, I'm not sure which, is producing some terrific dogs. My good friend Randy Smith from Mississippi hunts black and tans, has had some really good ones. I hated this week I saw that a dog named Mule that Randy, I believe he got Mule from Chad and trained him out and sold him to Jamie Perrin. And then Jamie sold him to, I think it's Bobby Talley, is it? Anyway, the partner of Bruce Gillum. And Bruce has been hunting this dog named Mule, a really nice black and tan. I was sitting in the lodge after the hunt one night when a big old stack of Benjamins were exchanged hands between Randy Smith and Jamie Perrin for Mule. But I don't know what happened to Mule, but the dog died this week. Oh. I don't know if it was a car accident or what. I don't know the details. I wish I did. But anyway, the black and tan breed is doing extremely well. Micah Ayers there in Kentucky, the gentleman we commonly call Flop. I can't remember his name right now. He hunts black dogs. There's just been, they've done exceptionally well. And there's some black dogs that have made it to the big show and done real well too. Yeah, we were talking about that earlier.
So just a little fun fact for everybody. This is going to make Steve feel old. I really enjoy making him feel old. I was born.
You don't have to do a darn thing.
So I was born in 1993. So that was 30 years ago.
Wow.
So I just went through the list of UKC show champions. UKC World Show Champions since 1993. 15 black and tan coonhounds made that list, whether they were a world show champion or they filled the reserve spot or the opposite sex spot.
That's
some representation right there. I mean, they're sharp looking dogs as it is, but you get a quality black and tan up there on the bench, man, and they're hard to look away from. But we also have, since 1993, we have two black and tans that have actually won the world hunt. And I think that you are very familiar with the dog from the 1995 world hunt specifically.
That was Randy Samuelson and Jeff Nelson. Jeff was a handler from Illinois and the J&R Northern Buck 2 dog. We had a great world championship that year in South Boston, Virginia. And Buck 2 was our first black and tan world champion at UKC. And did a great job, and of course I think all the black and tan fanciers around the country were glad to see a black dog rise to the top. I think one a little more in your era, maybe, Corey, won it too.
Yeah, 2017. So if anybody remembers the year 2017 as it relates to the UKC World Hunt, that was the year that the UKC World Hunt was re-ran. And that's kind of, something that hasn't been seen in the history of the UKC events, or especially the UKC World Championship. And in the rerunning of the UKC World Championship, a black and tan female, a seven-year-old black and tan female, champion, Grand Night champion, PR, Nelson's Northern Roxanne, was victorious. She was owned by Patrick Stewart and Bobby Talley.
Well, you mentioned 2017, and I go back 1 year earlier. I was privileged to judge the UKC World Show Championship in Greencastle, Indiana, and the final two dogs got down to a blue tick female, Whitney Killo, and your buddy up there from Pennsylvania, Dave Myers. And yep. I can't remember the name of Dave's dog. You probably do. I don't know a tremendous Doc. Black and tan male.
He calls him Doc.
Doc. Okay. Doc was his name. Wow. And those dogs were the final two. And on that day, Whitney emerged the world champion, and Doc was a reserve. But just phenomenal. And then, you know, they continue on showing those amazing black dogs and hunting them. So Dave and Kelly Myers there from Pennsylvania are definitely in the thick of it with black dogs today. And Dave Gilman out in Illinois has been a real positive force with black dogs, and always popping up in the winner's circle one way or the other, you know. And my old bud, all these things come to mind as we start talking about black dogs.
Well, that's the cool thing about the breed. Like, I'd have to take my shoes and socks off to count the amount of great people that I've met in that breed. It's fantastic. So,
well, you can't go ahead.
Well, I saved this story for our conversation about the common era, as far as what my experience with black and tan coonhounds has been. I've only owned one in my entire life. Now, when I was a kid, I got started showing dogs by showing AKC confirmation shows. So I showed quite a few black and tan coonhounds for different people that I knew, different breeders from across the country. That was pretty cool to be able to do that and to learn that way. But the very first black and tan coonhound that I own, it was a collaborative effort between David Gilman and Philip Heron to get him to my house. Philip Heron's from Arkansas, and anybody that knows Philip, he's always wearing a 10-gallon hat and has a cigar in his mouth and overalls on. But he's a great guy. And Philip, at the time, I had a Walker female that I was trying to get bred. And she didn't take. And I was at the UKC Youth Nationals that day that she was supposed to have puppies, and she didn't have any puppies. And I was sitting there talking with Philip Heron and telling him how disappointed I was that I wasn't going to have a pup to train this fall. And Philip said, well, he said, I can remedy that situation. He's like, I've got a litter of pups that'll be ready to go at Autumn Oaks. He said, it's out of one of David Gilman's stud dogs. And I'm really having high hopes for this litter. So I'd love to just give you one. And I hem-hawed around about it and all that. And finally, I called Philip up and I said, yeah, you've talked me into it. I'll pick him up at Autumn Oaks. It was a male puppy. So I ended up picking the puppy up from David Gilman. And I brought the pup home. And I'll tell you what, he didn't last long at my place. I could not break that sucker to barking. Couldn't break him in the kennel barking. And we didn't get along for that reason. And unfortunately, that pup found his way out real quick.
Well, Philip, as I'm looking here at this copy of American Black and Tan Coonhound Association Yearbook, 1972, at the top of the page inside is the name Philip D. Heron. Philip gave me this book. I see Philip every year when I go to Arkansas. He always comes over and visits with us and sometimes, you know, hunts with us. But his grandson, Kevin, usually makes a habit of hunting with us several nights while we're there. Philip is a guy that has a real passion for the youth and has done a lot of good work with the Black and Tan Association. And I don't know anybody that works harder for their association than he does. You know, he sold me a membership to the association. I was getting those yearbooks every year at the White River. He'd say, "Well, I guess you know what I'm going to ask you next. You'll pay your dues." And
I met Philip at my very first Black and Tan. Well, it wasn't my very first Black and Tan days, but it was my very first Black and Tan days working as a UKC associate. That was out in Flora, Illinois at Charlie Brown State Park. And I'll tell you what, Black and Tan days, man, if you want to go and you want to see a lot of coon dogs at one time, you got to go to Black and Tan days. My Lord, I've never seen so many Black and Tans. I haven't seen that many coon hounds in my lifetime at an event. It's just crazy. Yeah,
they've always been. They're breed hunter on Thursday night. Back in my tenure, was typically 300 and more dogs on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
And that was before it was even a licensed hunt. That was before the days of the breed RQEs. You know, back in that day, they just had a breed hunt usually on Friday or Thursday night that was non-licensed. Yeah, the Mecca of coon hunting, Flora, Illinois. Amazing place. If you ever get a chance to go to Charlie Brown Park, go in the headquarters building there where the kitchen is and just look at the plaques around the wall there and see how many major events that club has held. World Yes. championships of every stripe, breed days, plot days, Black and Tan, I'd say would probably be the two that they've held the most. But amazing club there. So many names come to mind there of people that, you know, that just were so engaged in coon hunting, so much a part of the history. You know, folks, the reason we talk about this history of these breeds and all, for me, is to honor those that have laid the foundation, who have paved the way, who, without these people, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We would not be having podcasts and YouTube channels and you know, media companies being formed and all the things that are going on in our sport today. We wouldn't have it without these pioneers. Dal Johnson is a Black and Tan figure that I remember very well from Fairfield, Illinois, just south of Flora. Daryl liked his mules. He would often be seen on the grounds at Flora riding a mule. Died in the wool, Black and Tan fancier. There's just so many names and important personalities. They weren't all charismatic and flamboyant like Willie Davis. Some of them were very quiet and humble individuals, but they loved that breed. And my old hunting buddy in Michigan, Bud Bauer, his hearing had been wrecked by the steel or the paper mills in Kalamazoo. He was a farmer. He loved the Black and Tan. He had some long-eared dogs that he'd gotten from Bobby Keister up in northern Michigan when I first went up there, and they were old, and Bud had quit, and I brought him out of retirement, and man, did the stories he could tell about hunting with those old black and tans. It's our heritage, guys. It's our foundation. It's our roots. And to me, it's just very, very important. And if you don't enjoy listening to it, that's the beauty of these things, these podcasts or whatever. All you got to do is flip on by and go listen to, you know, the boys in South Carolina talk about Bigfoot. That's fun, too. But, you know, I just love the history.
That was an ironic choice of words, using Bigfoot, because if I'm not mistaken, there was a prominent stud dog named Bigfoot in the black and tan breed at one time.
Was he a black dog?
Oh yeah, he was a black dog. Yeah. So. All right.
Well, now they want them with those little tight cat feet, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sir. I full-heartedly agree with you there, Steve. You know, it's so interesting to get in behind these breeds that we commonly see and that are used in the sport today, and just see where they came from, what it took to get them there. Talk about these prominent people that put in so much work and devotion into making these breeds what they are today. And my big thing with the history behind these breeds is we have to be good stewards of what we've been given. And in the art of stewardship, we have to have these kinds of conversations, and we have to recant these stories so that people will know about them, and that there's record of what has been and what will forever be because of these people. And that's where my soul is invested in even having a conversation about the black and tan coonhound breed, because it's just as important as having a conversation about any of the other breeds.
Oh, absolutely. And this narrative could easily be, you know, we could change the names and change the color of the dogs, and we could have these same discussions, and we plan to, about the other breeds. But, you know, these pioneers, they had goals, and they had purpose, and they had pride in these breeds. And I guess that's why I'm not a great big crossbred, X-bred fan. I'm a purebred guy. I love to look at the history of these breeds, and I know the dedication that went in to the building of these dogs. And these people that we've mentioned, these personalities, they were totally dedicated. No, were there some guys that slipped off behind the barn and bred old Bruiser to another breed? Absolutely. DNA came along and helped resolve a lot of those issues, you know. But I'm just not a big crossbred guy. I just look at the foundation that's been built. And I'm always, you know, with my own breed, I'm always looking to improve the dogs. But I prefer to do it within the guidelines and the boundaries of a given breed. Now, that might not be your cup of tea. You know, you guys out there that are listening, you may think, well, what I want to do is I want to improve my ideas of improving is by going outside and just breeding to a good coon dog. Well, let me tell you this. There are good coon dogs within the breed if you just look for them and search them.
Yes.
The mention I made of Hans Wagner, I thought it was interesting where the article talked about how he was willing to go out and find these good dogs to breed to. You know, they're out there. You just got to do your work. You know?
And even those that are utilizing a crossbred program or actively crossbreeding their dogs, they deserve to know the history behind the breeds that they're utilizing, too.
Oh, yeah.
So that way they can understand the math equation that they're producing.
Well, listen, I want to be very, very clear. I am not condemning anybody that chooses to crossbreed. The thing about the X-bred dogs and all, it brought it out to light, some of the things that were being done in the dark. And I applaud that. And if that's the route that someone chooses to take, then I'll fight for your right to do that. You know, the registry has said they will accept them, and so be it. You know, I'm just simply stating my personal preferences.
Absolutely. But,
yeah. Well, Mr. Groover, what say you? We kind of put a bow on this podcast. We've been at it about an hour and 35 minutes. Do we have anything else we want to talk about? Do we want to talk about anything off of the web? Interesting questions that have popped up on Coon Hunting Conversations or anything of that nature? Or you want to just go to bed?
Well, I think bed's calling my name, but before we sign off, I will add that, you know, having these kinds of conversations about the specific breeds is a good thing. And I think that it always generates thought provoking conversation that takes place outside of what we're recording here today. And I think this is a good starting point where we can continue the conversation, possibly at a later date, if that's what our viewership should desire of us. But
can't see us, Corey. I say that all the time. They can't see it. I have a face for radio.
Yeah.
But just kidding. It's late, brother. No. But carry on. Continue, please.
Yeah. So hopefully we can even continue this conversation about the black and tan breed. But we're going to try to bring the other stuff, too. We're going to talk about the English dogs. We're going to talk about the Walker breed. We're going to talk about plots, even. We're going to
imagine
try to
that.
Yeah, I know, right? We're going to hit the gauntlet. And I hope that you guys will send us your feedback and tell us how we're doing.
Well, absolutely. And I've always been told since I started down this podcasting road that the breed discussions or information is enjoyed. So we hope you enjoyed our ramblings around with the old, you know, there's a real famous dog named Tennessee Rambler. I saw on Facebook, and I'm glad I thought of this, and I didn't mention his name yet, but you can't mention black and tan coonhounds without mentioning old Pard. Do you know who Pard is?
Oh, I'm Corey? Not familiar with Pard, no.
Tam Young is 85 years old. Tam Young has been one of the most influential black and tan hunters and breeders of all time. He was a tugboat captain on the waterways there in Mississippi and Ohio. There, and he's from western Tennessee, I believe Adamsville. His son, Clay, has followed in his dad's footsteps. Great friends and close to Barry Kitty of Trent Walker fame, Wipeout Dogs. But Tam Young is one of the greatest guys that I've ever met in my life. Love every minute I've been able to spend with him and talk to him. He's the only coon hunter that I know that calls me Steven. Everybody else calls me Steve. He calls me Steven. And just love him to death. And happy birthday, Tam. I hope you're doing great. And I hope to see you soon.
Oh, what a way to end the podcast, man. That's great.
All right, folks. I think we've shined the tree for tonight. This old black dog here's about barked out. He's getting a horse. We're going to have to keep flipping one of these hauls I've been sucking on here throughout this.
We've got old Bruiser tied out back, Bruiser. And now we've got old and gray tied out.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't mention Tam Young without mentioning he was a guy that got into that crossbred pool a little bit with his rock dog. Was a Walker black and tan cross, a single registered dog that was a fame in hard rock. He was a famous winner at one time, was leading the all-time money leaders in PKC. So there's room for everybody under the tent, folks. Come on in. You're welcome here. And if somebody asks you where I am and where's Corey these days, he's out there trying to find that black and tan puppy let go because he heard he's a world beater now and he's trying to get him back.
He really is, too.
As for me, I'm just gone to the dogs. Good night, folks. We'll see you next time.
Good night, everybody.